treasury bonds. And so they could actually fund that position, as they say on Wall Street, with very little actual money. And so there were lots and lots of IOUs going through the system, and that's why it collapsed so quickly and so dramatically.
And the other piece of this is that these mortgages were throwing off money initially. You know, when the deals are created, these CDOs are actually producing some revenue, certainly enough revenue to pay off banker bonuses.
Because the source of revenue is essentially thousands of homeowners who have mortgages, and some of them are still able to make payments, right?
Exactly.
Right. And so, in effect, when we do a new deal and we generate a few million in commissions and bonuses, that's really coming out of what the homeowners are paying?
Not exactly. No, I mean, what's amazing about it is that the bankers get paid before the investors get paid. They get paid based on the closing of a deal. That's when the fee comes. So the fee is coming essentially from borrowed money that is backed by the mortgages that will eventually supposedly be paid off.
And they're borrowing from whom?
They're initially borrowing from the CDO.
But ultimately, the banks are borrowing from each other in this incredibly interlocking global financial system that seizes up in September 2008 because of this very reason, that they're borrowing from each other, which is mind-bogglingly complicated. But they're borrowing in this very short-term market, overnight market, where they're going back and forth with hundreds of billions of dollars back and forth overnight. And that seizes up in part because the assets backing those promises to pay them back are CDOs that are supposedly AAA but no longer AAA.
And this is actually the question that we tried to answer in our third story, which we called the subsidy. And we looked at the biggest CDO producer during this period, which was Merrill Lynch. And we wanted to know why they would take so much of this stuff. You know, if there weren't investors for it, if it was clear that the market was retreating, not advancing, why would they take 80% of $1 billion or a $2 billion CDO? And we found this very complicated financial arrangement whereby the CDO business was not allowed to keep the stuff they were producing. As they would say, we're in the moving business, not the storage business. You know, it was obviously a bad incentive for them to keep the stuff that they were creating. So they created a special desk within the bank of traders, and these traders would take the CDO stuff that they couldn't sell. Now, why would the traders take it? Because traders want to make money, and what's their incentive to take a money-losing deal? And what was going on was that the CDO group was sharing their bonuses, sharing their profit with this new group of traders that had been created just to take it.
You know, just to follow up on Jake's point, I mean, this whole business was extraordinarily fake. It was based on demand that wasn't there and promises that couldn't be kept. And so when we came out of meetings starting to get glimmers of understanding about this, that this business that had been worth supposedly hundreds and hundreds of billions of dollars was really on an edifice of tissue, we were astonished. It was scary. It was terrifying. But these were all deals largely that had no substance behind them.
Did people in the business realize this at the time?
I think more people realized it than didn't, frankly. And the way that they sort of rationalized it was, if it's really that bad, if it really is such a tissue of sort of false promises, as Jesse said, then when it goes bad, it's going to go bad for everybody and it'll be, you know, colossal. And so we really don't have to worry about it. But certainly by 2007, there was a real understanding of this.
Yeah, you know, on Wall Street they say IBG, YBG. I'll be gone, you'll be gone. So let's just do the deal.
We found that in the last 2 years of the boom, nearly half of all the CDOs sponsored by Merrill Lynch, which was the lead CDO producer during this period, bought significant portions of other Merrill CDOs. So, I mean, clearly, when you're buying your own stuff, you know, and you're moving one unsold portion into another unsold portion, you understand that there's something seriously wrong.
We're speaking with Jake Bernstein and Jesse Eisinger. Their series, The Wall Street Money Machine, has just won the Pulitzer Prize for National Reporting. We'll talk more after a short break. This is Fresh Air. If you're just joining us, our guests are reporters Jake Bernstein and Jesse Eisinger. They work for the nonprofit investigative organization ProPublica. They've just won the 2010 Pulitzer Prize for National Reporting for their series on the financial crash called The Wall Street Money Machine. Among the things we've talked about is the lack of regulation over some of these instruments, like credit default swaps. I mean, nobody knew how many of these insurance policies Magnetar was buying on bad debt because they're not public records. If there were a real regulatory system in place at the time, with rules for transparency and integrity and some active monitoring and enforcement, how might all this have gone differently, you think? Take the Magnetar case.
I mean, that supposes, yeah, we could give everyone a pony, too. But
give them a pony for the purposes of this question. I mean, seriously, because I think this is the thing that Congress looks at. You know, we don't want this to happen again. You know, you want people to have the ability to be creative and to make money and have a financial system in which, you know, assets are used in creative ways. But we don't want this to happen again. And we want rules that will make some sense. And so I'm kind of... I mean, it's a big question, I know, but yeah.
One of the amazing things about what Magnetar did was they did it very quickly. They put together more than $40 billion worth of deals in about a year's time. And so I think it's always going to be hard for regulators to sort of be that on top of what's happening to stop that kind of behavior. But certainly if there had been more disclosure, if there had been more active policing, if there had been more of a deterrent factor, I think a lot of this would not have happened.
We've often said that we thought that the disclosure was the key here, because if an investment bank came to an investor with a disclosure and they said, okay, we've got an investment for you, a hedge fund actually asked us to create it, and, oh, by the way, the hedge fund has had a lot of influence over what kind of assets are backing this instrument. Oh, and by the way, they're betting against it. Would you like to buy it? That's the kind of disclosure that I think would have deterred an enormous amount of this activity.
Right. But the fact is that, I mean, I've read bond prospectuses before, and there's a lot of disclosure. I mean, they talk about every financial arrangement, potential litigation, and effect, you know, relevant laws. You're asking them to kind of disclose the sort of secret relationships. Can you legislate that?
Well, this is actually one of the things about disclosure, right? I mean, you've looked at these prospectuses; they're 300 pages. They've got all kinds of ifs and buts and wherefores, a lot of legalese, and a lot of sort of hypothetical in quotes scenarios, and that's obviously not helpful. But, I mean, if there are specific things that are happening in the construction of the deal, they should not be buried in a 300-page prospectus in a way that it's not clear that this is actually happening.
Let me ask a specific question about credit default swaps. And when we talked about these, are essentially insurance contracts. I mean, if I can make an arrangement with an insurer which says that a multi-billion-dollar security that I don't even own, I can make a bet that it's going to collapse by paying a little premium, and then the insurer writes me a contract that says, okay, we'll take your money, and then if it does collapse, you'll get X, you know, hundreds of millions of dollars. Now, in casualty insurance, I mean, that's a regulated industry by states, right? And I don't think I can go and buy an insurance policy on a warehouse down the street from me in which I make money if it burns down. Yeah. Should this be permitted? I mean, it's a private financial contract, but should these kinds of arrangements be permitted? Should they be public records like a mortgage? I mean, you can look at mortgages in county records offices.
Well, you're certainly right that in the insurance business, you cannot take out insurance without an insurable interest. And so there's a good argument that the credit default swap market shouldn't exist the way it does. I'm not entirely persuaded. I think that if credit default swaps were traded on an open market where the prices were visible to people, where there was some disclosure of the ownership or exposure, and where, and this is the key, you had to put up some capital, then I think that the market would be a lot safer. And we're moving in that direction. I'm not entirely convinced that we're going to get there. But the problem with credit default swaps was largely that you didn't have to put up anything. You could just promise to pay off the insurance at some point, and AIG did this to the tune of hundreds of billions of dollars, saying we'll just pay this off when and if there's any problem, and then they couldn't. And when the crisis happened, and that's why the government had to take them over.
I mean, credit default swaps completely magnified what happened. I mean, you could take a mortgage bond that was, say, worth $10 million, and there could be 50 times that in credit default swaps on it. So when that $10 million mortgage bond went bad, the impact of that was not just $10 million. It was many, many millions of that.
Right. And the problem was not the buyers of the insurance, largely, although with Magnetar, they were bringing these things into creation that were going to fail and amplify the losses and that would not have otherwise been created. But the real problem was the sellers, the people who were offering to insure things. They were concentrated. They were the big insurance companies. They were the big banks. And when they couldn't make good on their promises, that's when they collapsed and when the global financial system collapsed and when we had to have all the bailouts.
And what's amazing is that in the deregulatory mania of the early 2000s, Congress actually forbade the SEC from regulating this stuff.
Right.
So for 10 years, there was no regulation of this. And it sort of blossomed into this mammoth market. And I think it's sort of a case study on the danger sometimes of deregulation.
Well, Jake Bernstein, Jesse Eisinger, thanks so much for speaking with us.
Thanks so much for having us.
Thank you, Dave.
Jake Bernstein and Jesse Eisinger spoke with Fresh Air contributor Dave Davies. Bernstein and Eisinger just won a Pulitzer Prize for national reporting for their series The Wall Street Money Machine, which was published by the online investigative nonprofit ProPublica. We'll close with the song they mentioned that was commissioned by This American Life for their Magnetar story. It was composed by Robert Lopez, who co-wrote the songs for Avenue Q and the new Broadway hit The Book of Mormon. The singers are John Tracy Egan and Christian Borrell. Fresh Air's executive producer is Danny Miller. Our engineer is Audrey Bentham. Dorothy Farabee is our administrative assistant. Our associate producer for online media is Melody Kramer. Roberta Shurock directs the show. I'm Terry Gross.
Step one. We write a check for $10 million, hand the check to a Wall Street bank, and ask them to make us a CDO. Step two. They create the CDO using risky stuff. Very risky stuff. Extremely risky stuff. Step three. Other investors commit hundreds of millions of dollars to the CDO. Step four. We bet against the CDO using a credit default swap. Step five. The housing market crashes, the CDO's value drops to zero, our bet pays off, and we make hundreds of millions of dollars, and before you can say step six, we're rich! We're gonna bet against the American dream. We're gonna be on the winning team. Purchase risky debt on a massive scale. Then place a bet that the debt will fail.
Hundreds of millions for Magnetar. The economy collapsing like a dying star.
No one will know till it's on NPR. And